Thank you, Fred. I wanted to present here some of the work that we have been developing in the lab in the last few years. And one of the main topics in the lab has been to develop hypotheses or ideas about how two interacting cortical areas accomplish a job together. What is the advantage of having them together, or how can we understand or start understanding how cortical areas interact with each other? So we have been applying or approaching this topic for working memory and for attention. And today I wanted to tell you about attention. If you're interested about working memory, we can discuss that. So these are two very closely interrelated cognitive functions. But let me just be specific about what it's going to be the primary focus of my model here. And I'm going to be talking about feature-based attention. And let me explain it by an example, what we mean by feature-based attention. So if I present you with this picture, and I ask you to scan it or to explore with all the information that I'm presenting to you, you're going to see yourself scanning the picture, moving your eyes from one point to another, and you're going to have a difficult time really grasping all the details about this. Now, if I tell you beforehand that what I'm interested in is, or I'm looking for a person that is wearing a yellow cap, you're going to see that your visual system is amazingly efficient in finding this person over here or that guy over there very, very efficiently. Your system has been able to extract those yellow caps out of the picture without you actually fixating it and directing fixation up to that point. So this capacity of our visual system of really extracting information out of based on prior information that I gave you is what is being called feature-based attention. So it's not really attending to particular location, but is attending features, in this case yellow cap, what is directing your visual system to react and operate differently. So this has been studied electrophysiologically in monkeys in the last few decades, and there are two, as we know, in the visual. This is a picture of the visual monkey of the cortex of the macaque, and there are two main pathways in the visual cortex. One is ventral, the other is dorsal. In the ventral pathway, objects are being represented. In the dorsal pathway, it's mostly about spatial relationships, what is being represented here. And attention has mostly focused on two areas in each of these two pathways, V4 in the ventral pathway, MT in the dorsal pathway. In these two areas, if you put an electrode, you can find neurons that respond to visual objects or to visual motion, to visual space, that have very clear tuning curves to those features. But at the same time, they are very, very sensitive to the context or the attentional state that the monkey is in. And here, I just wanted to, so I'm going to be talking mostly about these two areas. But in the end, I'm going to focus mostly on MT to be very specific and extract data to constrain the model. The task that monkeys typically do, and here I'm going to be presenting a feature-based attention task specifically, would be something like this. So you record from the monkey, say, area MT. You put your electrode there, you identify a neuron, and you detect where the receptive field of that neuron is. That would be this dashed line here. Then you instruct the monkey what the relevant feature is going to be. In this case, it could be upward or downward motion in this location. So that is done by presenting briefly a patch of motion, in this case random dot patterns, in this location, indicating either upward or downward motion. That's just a cue that's telling the animal this is what is interesting. And then the real test appears. In that case, it's two patches, one in the receptive field, another outside. And the task of the monkey is to detect when the patch in the receptive field, so say in this case, you can have two directions of motion now in the receptive field, and the monkey has to detect when the direction of motion that was cued in the first hand changes speed or changes color or changes something. So you have to detect a change here in the direction of motion that was previously cued. And so nothing regarding the stimulus in the receptive field. The stimulus in the receptive field is not behaviorally relevant. Now, because you are cueing one of the two directions, that is going to have an effect on the responses to this in that neuron because of this feature-based attention. So it's not about where the item is, but it's about what it contains in this case. So this is a way in which people have found that neurons in MT that would, as you map the responses to several stimuli, the responses are changed depending on whether it attends outside to one motion or the other. And that's what is characterized as feature-based attention. Now, the field of selective attention is interesting for modelers because there's a great deal of data there. So there's a lot of information that we can use to constrain our models. And I'm going to be flexible here. I'm going to put together data that has been obtained both in feature-based and in spatial-based attention. When the same experiments or similar experiments have been performed with the two types of attention, the results have been very similar. So I'm just going to be, I'll try to constrain it with as much as we have. So I'll present you with some of the important observations that have been accumulating in this field. And so I'll talk about biased competition, multiplicative modulation, selective enhancement, and synchronous oscillations that have been observed in most of these areas, sometimes in just one of them. And I will not speak today about two of the other very exciting results in this field, contrast and attention, or correlations and attention, that are catching a lot of interest lately. And that is also something we want to model and study. In fact, the contrast and attention problem is something that David here has thought a lot about. And when he comes back to AKITP in a couple of weeks, we're going to work together to see how we can put together these two views into my model. And then correlations and attention is another thing we are going to start working on. But let me focus on these four phenomena, four observations that have been made. I'll present them now. So now I'm going to present these literature, this some of the results here. Then I'll present the model, and then I'll show you how the model can explain this. So bias competition is was defined by Desmond and Duncan. And based on the observation that if you present, this would be an area of E4, I'm going to show this data. If you present a stimulus in the receptive field for which the neuron is selective, in this case a flower, the neuron fires briskly and at a high rate, you get this high rate. If you present a stimulus for which the neuron is not selective, the neuron does not respond a lot. Now, if you present the two stimuli together in the receptive field, what you get is an intermediate response. So it looks like the two items are competing. That's the sort of abstract reasoning that, or the reason they put this name, biased competition. The thing is, well, the competition. This is a competition, and the bias is what attention does. So when you instruct the monkey in the presence of the two items in the receptive field to attend to the one that the neuron prefers, the neuron response increases to the level that it would have had without the non-selective stimulus. Conversely, if in the presence of these two items in the screen in the receptive field, the monkey is attending to the one that is non-selective for the neuron shows a suppression of the response that goes close to what it would have if the non-selective item was presented in isolation. Yeah.
Okay, so did you say what
in area V4. V4. This is V4. It has been observed in area MT too. But yeah, this is the earlier result. this is also in area V4. And this is another result that was different. So here, you don't present two items in the receptive field. You just present one item. In this case, it's a bar, an oriented bar. And the receptive field of the neuron, now you instruct the monkey to pay attention to it or to something else, fixation or another stimulus. And then you compare, and then you change this the orientation of this tuning curve, of this bar, and you can plot the tuning curve. And then you can compare this to conditions when the same stimulus was mapped in the receptive field, and in one case the monkey was paying attention to it, in the other case it was not. And what you find, what McAdams and Mounsell found, was that the tuning curve got scaled by a multiplicative factor. And this was also observed in area MT, or very, very similar. So this is area V4. So the difference with the previous result is, in the previous result it was emphasized the fact that you need two items in the receptive field that creates competition, and attention solves the competition. In this case, it's a single item. It already a single item gets a modulation by attention that is quite sizable, or at least comparable to what you find with, or it was smaller, but not that far from what you see in bias competition. And then there was a very clever, very elegant study by Stefan Troye and Martinez Trujillo, in which they did the following experiment. This was feature-based attention. So now there were random dot patterns presented in, bilaterally, and one of them was in the receptive field, and that was not behaviorally relevant. So all the monkey had to do was to attend to the one that was not in the receptive field of the neuron. And what they did is make the monkey attend to a specific direction of motion while the motion in the receptive field was varied. What they found there was that the attentional condition multiplied the tuning curve. Now, if instead of doing that experiment, what they did was to change simultaneously the attention, the attended motion, and the mapped motion in the receptive field. If they did that, what they found is that what attention did was to enhance for the preferred direction of the neuron and suppress for the non-preferred direction of the neuron. So if you think about it, and that's what they argue in their paper, what they're doing by mapping together, by changing together attention and stimulus in the receptive field, is mapping a possible population activity, if you think about symmetry, right? So you change all attention and where you put your stimulus solidly, and then it would be the same as having attention and stimulus fixed and moving across the population if everything was isotropic and homogeneous. Instead, if you fix your attention and you move your stimulus, you're really specifically analyzing what one neuron does and not what the population does. So they would say, well, what the neurons do is scaling, but what the population does is to refine its selectivity. Each neuron gets a different scaling factor. Some are larger than one, others smaller than one. And in the end, you get the population to get selectivity enhancement. And you know, this is so I'm going to show how a network can do this. And but this was a result that I think is very interesting here in the literature. Yes. No. So we're coming back to one of the problems that came out in the other talks, separating single neurons and population. When you map a tuning curve, you're not doing population. You're looking really at what a single neuron does across trials. And in the case in which in the attention, so that is a proxy to population activity in many cases, but not here, because here you have a biasing that if you don't make sure that you stay, it stays at about the same location relative to where your population activity is. If it changes from trial to trial, then you're going to mix up things, and you're going to get something that occurs only on across trials and not in a fixed trial, in a single trial. So in a single trial, if the population would be homogeneous and isotropic, so possibly this would be what the population is having is doing, and that's what a downstream area would be seeing. So downstream area would be seeing this single activity profile being fed to it. Make sense? Okay, and another result that has sparked a lot of interest in the last few years has been the fact that attention has also been seen to enhance oscillatory activity in area V4 and also in area MT. There's some data, although not that strong. But so essentially here you have the spike field coherence. You can also see it in the power spectrum, the spectral grid average. What you see is that in the unattended condition, you have a certain coherence that peaks around within the gamma range. And then when you have the monkey attend, so again, it's the same physical stimulus. It's only the internal state of the monkey what changes. Then you see that the oscillations have been kind of increased. And the same, you could, so there was an experiment which they did simultaneous recordings in two areas, LIP and MT, and they did find that also the coherence between the two areas was enhanced during attention. So this is really the Fourier transform of the spike train multiplied by the Fourier transform, the complex Fourier transform, complex conjugated Fourier transform of this, and divided by the spectra of each one of them. And that goes together with more recent results, which have shown, on the other hand, that despite there is this enhancement of oscillations at the same time, if you look at the variability in these areas, it remains very high. And it's somewhat modulated by attention. It drops by attention slightly, but it's not a huge effect. So our variability remains very high. So you have this possible dichotomy between an enhancement of oscillations that should make things more regular, and on the other hand, variability remaining relatively high all the time and only being sizably smaller in narrow spiking neurons and not for a whole lot. Well, here's Fanon factor across trials. Right, it's 100 millisecond bins. Makes it 40 hertz, 25 milliseconds. Yeah. It's four periods of the oscillation. Yeah. Could be done better to address that issue. Yes, it's in relatively small bins. Yeah, but here have the count variance, spike count variance, mean spike count, and you know, the Fanon factor would be the relationship between the two. I don't quite understand why they chose to do that, because yeah, if you think so, in the end, the log of the Fanon factor is the difference between these dots and the straight line. So it's a funny way. Yeah, I don't see why they chose that. Okay, so well, what I wanted to show here is that there have been different observations accumulating in the field when you do different experiments in the similar topic. It's the same system that does it. So we want to understand how this all comes together. So when you look at what is the effect of attention on complex scenes, cluttering, then you see bias competition. But if you think about how attention affects tuning curve, you see multiplicative scaling. And now if you go at the population level, it seems like what's happening, selectivity enhancement. But at the same time, all this happens while synchrony is strongly modulated, but variability, Fanon factor, is just slightly changed. So we would like to put this together in a framework so that we could understand how things relate to each other and how difficult it is to accomplish this, or what are the constraints on a model that we want to do this. So, yeah. So this is the network model that we thought could be built to understand this set of data, and that we take as a possible model where we want to integrate further data also into it. So we are going to think about an upper area that I call LIP, prefrontal cortex, an area that supports persistent activity. That's the whole point. So the real label I put is just one. This is a persistent activity area. The bottom network is a sensory area, and it could be MT or V4, because that's where all these effects have been observed. And I'm going to be focusing mostly on V4. So we have population of excitatory and inhibitory neurons in each one of them. The two networks are essentially the same, And the only thing that changes is the couplings, how strongly coupled they are. So the prefrontal cortex has strong excitatory coupling, whereas the MT network will have more inhibition in it. But in terms of structure, it's the same. So we have Gaussian couplings. It's a ring model. So neurons are disposed on the ring according to what direction of motion they're going to prefer. And connectivity between the neurons depends on how far they are on the ring. According to a Gaussian law, there are excitatory inhibitory neurons. Inhibition is typically non-selective, so it goes to all neurons equally. And then we're going to couple these two networks through bottom-up and top-down connections that are all excitatory. And we get sensory input to the sensory network. Neurons are integrin fire neurons. And synapses are modeled with conductance-based AMPA and MDA and GABA-A synapses. So, and we, what we want is to reproduce these responses in area MT when we have attention, and attention is going to be accomplished through this an upper network. We want a model that integrates both this internal state of the animal up here and the sensory representation in the lower network, and we want to see how the attentional effects are interacting. No, no plasticity. Okay, so what we use, so what does the MT, I told you that the prefrontal, this upper network is going to be persistent activity network. Now what about the lower network? So the lower network, we also wanted to do some, to perform a computation. And what, so the computation that we're going to be implementing in MT is this normalization when simultaneous motion is presented in the receptive field. This was a study in 91 by, in which they presented motion to V1 cells or to MT cells. And they showed that in V1, neurons would respond to the preferred motion with stronger firing rate. But when both the preferred and non-preferred motion were superimposed on the receptive field, the neuron wouldn't seem to care about the non-preferred motion. It kept firing at about the same rate as it would with the preferred motion. And this is the population data at about centered, at about no change. Instead, if you look at MT, what you find is that when you present this transparent motion, you get a suppression, a significant suppression of the response to the preferred motion. It seems like the non-preferred direction is suppressing the preferred direction response, and this is a population. So there is some computation going on here. What V1 produces is different from what MT represents. So we want this, so this is what our MT will do. And this was further demonstrated by Stefan Troye in another paper in which he actually, this was a monkeys, awake monkeys, but they were fixating. So it's a fixation task. And the monkeys are just fixating, and in the receptive field of the neuron, they present these motions, superimposed motions with different separations between the two items, the two motions, and they find that the response of the neuron gets suppressed as you put your items separated. And in fact, what they found is that the area below this curve was more or less constant. So it was like a normalization to constant area happening in MT. So we put that in MT. So that's going to be the computation that our MT network does. So the MT is going to do this computation. It normalizes inputs to the area of the population activity that it gets. And the way we do it work is by having a strong feedforward inhibition. So this would be the case in which you put one item. If you put one direction of motion in the receptive field, what you get is a response in inhibitory neurons, a response in excitatory neurons. And now when you put two direction of motions in the receptive field, you get a strong representation of these two motions in the inhibitory neuron that enhances this inhibition because it's flat, it's non-selective. What it does is just to project an inhibition that proportional to the mean of this activity, and that suppresses the activity here through the threshold. So we can get this normalization happening. So this has an implication or a prediction, which is that we would get it, that inhibitory neurons would not do the normalization. So here is the network, this empty network. One item is, this is when the item is presented. And here's the network, all the neurons disposed orderly. And this is time, and you see that there is this bump of activity in response to the injected input. Now, if you put two items, what you get is this suppression in the two tails. So we're gonna, so this is what actually the network gives us, but we're gonna be representing the averages of these things over time. So more sort of population activity profiles. So this is the model output, the average of those spectrums that I showed you before. And here you get what we actually inject into the network, possibly coming from area V1. So this is the inputs coming from V1, and this is what the MT gives us an output, just through this feedforward inhibition that suppresses. Okay, so this is the, and then the other area, the prefrontal area, is this percent activity area. So it's this model that I developed before to represent the activity recorded in prefrontal cortex during oculomotor delayed response tasks, in which the monkey had to fixate, then a target appeared peripherally, it went away, the monkey kept fixation for a delay period, after which the fixation disappeared, and then the monkey had to make a saccade eye movement to the location of the target. During the delay period, that's the interesting part of the task, some neurons in prefrontal cortex show this elevated firing rate that was tuned to the location of the stimulus. And we could reproduce that with a network model where there was this recurrent excitation that helped in maintaining this bump of activity through the delay. So here is where a cue is applied, and then it goes away, and it is maintained. What we found also in that paper is that in these networks, it's easy to have oscillations happening, just because there is this strong interplay between excitation and inhibition, and that has been shown before that it's a very easy way of getting oscillations. Yes. When? No. Here, no. No, only when you have this stronger. And that, it's going to depend on how strong you put what the time constants of your excitation are, and how strong they are. But in general, no. This is you get a strong oscillations during the active work. So that's interesting because that's going to help us in trying to put together the oscillation story with in the attention network, circuit network. Okay, so then we have these two networks, a network for MT that we modeled to be able to do this normalization of the area, and then the prefrontal network that can do persistent activity. And now we hook them together. And we can get from this network activity as a form of the membrane voltage of the neurons or spike strains of the whole population. Or we can get averages over time across population, then we get population profiles, so we can get average over the population across time, and we get LFPs, or we can module. Yes. Integrate and fire. So this, now we have this model, and we're going to run it through a task. So this, let me show you what the task, this hypothetical task is that our model is going to be going through. So there is a fixation, that means nothing happens in either of the modules. Then there is a cue appearing outside the receptive field, so that means prefrontal, that doesn't have receptive, it just sees everything. It's going to be informed about this, but not this our empty module. And this is the cue that tells prefrontal what is going to be interesting, either upward motion or downward motion. Then there's going to be a delay, and then after that delay, there's going to be a stimuli presented now in the receptive field, so our empty network will respond to that. And the task is to detect a change in one of the stimulus, but we're going to be focusing all the time in this test period. So we want to see how our empty network responding to this stimulus is affected by what was loaded, what is being attended to from the prefrontal network. And there are various conditions that are interesting. One is attend the same when the attention is being directed to the same direction of motion as the stimulus, or attend different when the attention is directed away from the direction of motion of the stimulus, or one in which attention is directed to something totally different, in which case our prefrontal network that cares about direction of motion will not be engaged. And that's the no attention condition. No. Yeah, so this, you know, how would you do it with an animal? If you wanted an animal to do this, and this is feature-based attention, the animal would have to detect the change in something that is outside the receptive field. So you would have to present another stimulus outside the receptive field so the monkey could actually do the task and detect that change. In our simulations, we're not simulating what happens outside of the receptive field of our patch of neurons, so we're not really doing anything regarding this signal. So this signal is not being fed into any of our networks. But if you would think of a monkey doing this task, you would need the monkey to do something away from the receptive field, and then you would need the stimulus there. Right. The working memory is keeping it throughout. Exactly. It's not in my model, but it should be in a task if the monkey, because the monkey would have to attend somewhere, the monkey would have to detect something, and you don't want it to be in the receptive field because then you put into spatial attention, and we want to keep it simple, just one. But for my model, this is not driving any input into my networks. No. So you're saying that there are models that show theta, or in the data? Mm-hmm. Right, the facilitation. Mm-hmm. Right. So, yeah, gamma oscillations come from the time constants of the synaptic currents here, and there it comes from the synaptic. In practice, in experiments, the only finding of working memory and oscillations in electrophysiology that I know of is by Richard Anderson, and that found gamma range oscillations. Here, in our context here, so what people have found for attention is gamma range changes. So that's why it's good to use this model as a generation of gamma oscillations. Yes. This is the cue to a monkey that says your task is to detect changes in this direction of motion. Then there comes a delay. And in fact, so this figure is not correct. So what there should be here is two motions, one up and one down. That means then the monkey needs to remember what it has to attend to actually do the task and detect a change in only the direction of motion that it was cued for. That means it's going to be attending to these two motions here, but it only has to report changes that occur in the upward motion. If anything happens to the downward motion, it has to ignore it. That's the task, right? And then, so that's a difficult task. And then the 10 same and 10 different is relates to what you put in the receptive field. But this is not behaviorally relevant. So it only drives your neuron, and you want to see changes in the firing rate of your neuron because of what the monkey is attending to elsewhere. So it's this feature-based attention. So that should be a better, yeah. Is it clear now? But it's not relevant for our network because this is not in the receptive field of that network. That is representing neurons that respond to a single receptive field for all directions of motion. Okay, so then we have, this is just two examples then of what an attention and a no attention trial would mean specifically in our simulation. So here is time, here is our empty network, time, our prefrontal network. These are two different simulations. In this simulation, it's a no attention condition, so the prefrontal is not loading anything. So it's all responses in MT are purely sensory-driven responses. Now, in the attention condition, before you present something into MT, there is this other item that appears elsewhere, but it gets loaded into prefrontal and it stays there. So this is the Q period when the current arrives into prefrontal, then it goes away. It's maintained in prefrontal through this reverberation activity. And then when you present the stimulus in MT, it gets affected by what comes up from this prefrontal network that is keeping something in mind. So, and that's what we want to compare. We want to compare these two conditions, the responses of the empty circuit to the sensory without any top-down, and when the top-down comes from this prefrontal working memory circuit. Here you have sample traces of what it would be like to see an attention trial, a non-attention trial, the STHs. And here is the population activity during this test period where in MT. So when we present the MT stimulus, and we want to see how the population responds to this activity. And what we tune the network to show this. So this enhancement at the peak and suppression in the tails of this population activity profile, because this is what came from the data. Right, so this is part of the tuning of the network, tuning the top-down connection. So in order to get this, the top-down connection needs to go to both excitatory and inhibitory neurons, and very strongly to inhibitory neurons in order to be able to get the suppression of the tails. So you get this bump is exciting here, but it's also suppressing these guys because it's exciting the inhibitory neurons that feed forward inhibition to the tails of the population activity. So we get this, and one way to quantify, which is the same that they did in their paper, is to plot the ratio of these two curves. Then you get the modulation ratio. It's larger than one at the peak and smaller than one at the tail. Okay, so this is, so far we have built the network. We have hooked together the two networks in order to produce something that has been seen in the data. But then we did one experiment, which there was no tuning anymore, which was to test what happens with tuning curves. So now we take a single neuron, and this neuron over here, and we map, we put stimuli in MT at different locations, right? While attention in the prefrontal network is at either one location or another, so either in the preferred or in the non-preferred location. So your prefrontal network always keeps the bump, this activity, in the same location, while in MT we put activity in different points, right? And we just get the activity of a single neuron. When we do that, we get these tuning curves, right? So tuning curves now are multiplicative, so one from one another. So when you get this, the activity of this neuron here, and attention is right on its preferred direction, then we get this green tuning curve. When attention is to the null direction, then you get the red tuning curve, and they overlap with each other by a scaling factor. So that means that multiplicative the tuning curves of individual neurons, when you do the experiment this way, are multiplicative. instead, if you look at the population activity at a single trial, it's always the profile refines, and you have a suppression at the tail and enhancement at the beginning. And this comes naturally from this network without much more, without any other tuning than the one that I showed you before. And the reason why there is multiplication here is has been published before. It is a paper by Murphy and Miller that showed that when you have a power law input-output relationship in the neuron, additive inputs are going to be represented multiplicatively. And so the additive input would be this input coming from the attentional network. Because you keep attention fixed relative to the neuron, this additive neuron is the same for each one of these curves, so that it's always the same multiplicative factor across the tuning curve. Instead, if you take different neurons, what you get is a different multiplicative factor for each neuron, because the additive curve is different for each neuron. And then you get a non-multiplicative population activity modulation. And then we tried the two direction of motions presentation. So here we present two direction of motions, and then we put an item, and we make the network pay attention to one of them, and then the responses look like this. So here is the profiles, and you see that the response to the two items gets biased, much as like in biased competition. So the one that is attended to is enhanced, the one that is not attended to is suppressed. You can also look at what happens. So this would be in line with the biased competition results. Now, the other thing that you can look at is what happens in the delay period in between, when you don't have any stimulus and the only thing you have is the top-down coming from the upper network. And here is what you see. You have this activity in the without attention, it's totally flat. When you have something in the prefrontal, this network does show a modulation that is due to attention. And some papers have reported this, although it's very difficult to see in the data because it's a very small effect. And now the interesting thing that we realize is that when you get the modulation ratio for each one of these different ways in which you stimulate the network, all these modulation ratios fall on top of each other. So that means, irrespectively of what you present to the network is going to respond by multiplying. Each neuron has like a multiplicative factor attached to it that just applies to whatever current is coming and just multiplies it. So that happens irrespective of the stimulus. And this is the core of one of the theories that had been put forward by Stefan Troyer that's called feature similarity gain model. So this was a sort of very algorithmic sort of idea that that has been seen to hold in many experiments. And this is the first time that we could find in this model that it's actually easy to implement biophysically. And it comes out naturally from this network. So it doesn't really matter what stimulus you put in. The effect of attention is just this multiplicative factor across neurons, only that different neurons get different factors. And they come from this universal curve here. So this can be understood in this biophysical network to come from relatively simple connectivity structures. So the model can produce these three effects that I presented before. So activity enhancement just by construction, but then biased competition, multiplicative effect, and altogether response to this feature-based similarity model, only that now it's in biophysically concrete terms. We could test then exactly the mechanisms, and then here we can do selective manipulations to the model. So this would be the control in which we see the competition, one item, at minus 90 degrees, at plus 90 degrees, the two together, it's suppressed. Here we get the suppression in the tails, the selectivity enhancement. Here we get multiplicative scaling. This is all what I showed you before. Now, if we change something, like in this case, what we did is reduce the Poisson noise into our network. That makes the environment in which the networks live less noisy. And what that changed was not qualitatively this part, nor this part, but the multiplicative factor went away. So this is in line with this Murphy and Miller story that claimed that noise is important to make this power law FI curve, and that is responsible for multiplicative scaling. if what we do is remove the feedback inhibition or feedforward inhibition from bottom up, what we get is that this is removed, so the competition is gone. And if what we remove is a top-down inhibition, what we interfere with is the selective enhancement. So each one of these effects would have different mechanistic underpinnings. So this is my conclusions, the first part. So we can understand all these separate correlates of selective attention in a single model of two interacting modules. And we can identify a biologically plausible implementation of the feature similarity grain principle. And then we can propose what could be the mechanisms that are responsible for each one of these effects at the circuit level. So strong feedforward inhibition from V1, top down to excitatory ion inhibitor neurons, non-selective intracortical inhibition, and this noisy bath that generates the power law input-output. So what about synchrony? So here's where the fact of having an so all I have said could have been also shown without a spiking prefrontal network. But now, we take the opportunity because we have this spiking network up here to compare spike trains from these two networks and see what happens about synchrony. So we can get in this net from these networks spike trains. We can construct multi-unit by pulling together spikes. We can get LFPs, or we can just see at the whole population. LFPs here are taken as the sum of all the AMPA conductances. So it's like AMPA conductances. So it's like a filter on all the spikes, a short exponential filter on all the spikes. Yeah, it's not clear how one would do that. That's just a possible way. So here, a zoom, a little window of what we would see in a non-attention trial or in an attention trial. In the non-attention trial, the prefrontal network is not active, so we only see activity coming from the sensory input. In the attention case, we get both an activity here with this gamma oscillations being generated internally here in this network, and then we see here how this affects, this top-down affects the dynamics in this area. So we can compute the same quantities that they have been using experimentally, in this case local coherence, and we see the coherence between the low LFP and the single unit activity in empty, in area empty. So say we have, this was the population activity during non-attention trials, the population activity in attention trials, and we're going to look at two neurons at the peak of the activity, or one neuron at the peak of activity in these two trials, and how it relates to activity in the population through this local coherence measure. This is the experimental data I showed before, and this is what we get in our model. So this would be without attention, and when we put attention in, because of this top-down input, we get an enhancement of oscillations in the gamma range. And what we found interesting that hasn't been shown experimentally and is something, yes? The conductance is of all the network, yeah. Not just your neuron. Well, if there are no oscillations in your circuit, you're not going to see coherence between your neuron and the whole population, because the LFP is going to be, so the contribution of your spikes to the LFP are going to be so small that you're not going to see much, unless there is some coordination between different neurons. I'll show you some cases in which there is no coherence, like well here. Well, no, here it's different, because here what we tested is coherence between the two areas. So now we take neurons from the two areas, one neuron from prefrontal, one neuron from MT, and we look at how they are related, they're in coherence. So say we take two neurons that are firing strongly in the attention trials, and we get this strong coherence. They are very coherently firing. And then we take the same two neurons, but in a non-attention trial in which the prefrontal is not being engaged, and then we see that the coherence is gone. Yeah, it's not the same as you were saying, because these are two different networks. The two neurons come from two different networks. So this is similar to what people had seen in that other paper I presented, where they recorded simultaneously an MT and LIP, and they found enhanced coherence during attention trials. Now, what people hasn't reported and we think is interesting is the fact that when we take neurons that are either have different selectivity or are the same selectivity but in conditions in which attention is being directed different to where the stimulus is, what we find is totally no coherence at all. So it seems like here coherence is a very discrete detector of when we have a match, when what we're looking for is there. So only when what we're looking for is there, we have this strong coherence. Here, what we're looking for, what is in prefrontal, is not there because we're presenting this, and we don't get coherence, even though the two neurons are firing at high rates, and both networks in themselves have oscillations. But the coherence between the two is zero. So only when there is detection, when what you're looking for is there, you get this binary response or very, very clear response in coherence. So this is very different from what you see at the fine grade level, where you only see small tiny modulations. So that made us think, you know, if there would be a way of reading out this coherence between areas, it would be a very strong coding for detection. This is what I'm looking for is there. It's very easy to see here as opposed to from the firing rates. Well, we can see that recurrent AMPA is necessary for all this synchronization. So if we don't have AMPA receptors in either of our networks, our synchrony goes down totally. If we have it in only one of the networks, we remain, there's some remaining oscillatory activity. But you really need AMPA in both to generate this. And then finally, even though we see this strong oscillatory enhancement, at the same time, spiking activity is highly variable throughout. So this is the fan effector through our trial. So there is the Q, there is a drop in fan effector. The fan effector then during the delay, there's no response in MT anyway. And then during the test, there is again a drop, but it remains relatively high, and attention doesn't seem to change substantially the fan effector. Yes? Here was the coherence between the multi-unit activities. Right, you need it to read from two different areas, right? So you need is coherence between the two circuits, not within a circuit. It's the coherence between the two circuits. One would have to show how that would work. So this is to show that the fan effector remains high. It's higher for inhibitory neurons than for excitatory neurons. There is a small effect of attention, but not huge. It remains high throughout, even though we see these changes in oscillation. So this is in agreement with the data, too. So we see that the model is generally in agreement with the data regarding the dynamics of this of the two areas. And now we want to ask, the fact that these two areas synchronize, does this have any functional effect in the rate coding in MT? So this question comes from the following discussion in that Pascal Fries presented in this paper. So he says, well, a bit in line with what you were saying, if you have coherent activation of two different circuits or two different neurons, if they are in phase, when because they're in phase, they're going to be more effective in driving each other. Instead, if they're out of phase, the spikes will arrive at the will miss the peak of excitability, and they will not drive the other neuron so much, right? So this vision of how the synchronization between areas could be a way of actually routing information through a pre-established anatomical network. You have a pre-established anatomical network, and the way that you synchronize things is how your activity is going to be flowing through that network. It's a bit difficult to reconcile, or it has to be understood in the terms that, well, what neurons are doing is not really this in the cortex, but they are doing something like that. So is there really a peak of excitability? How would that work? So we can test just our network. In our network, we have two networks that are coupled to each other, that they are synchronized, and they cause rate effects. And we want to see how much of that rate effect is due to the synchronization per se, as opposed to just the enhancement of the input. So because we're in a model, we can do some things that cannot be done in experiments. So what we're going to do in order to change synchrony, but nothing else, or synchronization between the two circuits, but nothing else in our simulations, is the following trick. Every time that there is a spike in the prefrontal cortex, that spike in our control case would be transferred immediately to the postsynaptic neurons in MT. Instead of doing that, I'm going to wait a variable delay for each spike and for each postsynaptic neuron. So it's going to be I'm going to draw a number, a long delay, and that's going to tell me how long each spike from prefrontal cortex takes to actually reach each of its empty neurons. So empty postsynaptic neurons. Two postsynaptic neurons of the same cell will get the same spike at different times. What that makes is that the same activity in prefrontal is going to affect your MT network in the same way in terms of rate. It's going to get exactly the same spikes, but at shuffled times. So all the spikes will be arriving totally shuffled in time. So all the coherence will be gone, but all the rate effects should remain. So indeed, when we did that, coherence went down to the coherence in the non-attention case. The coherence between the two areas was totally removed. So the two areas were no longer coherent because now we were shuffling. There was this play in the middle that delayed all the spikes by random times. This is the local coherence in MT, yes, always. Yeah, the local coherence in MT remains because of the internal dynamics in MT. Yeah. In purpose. So the idea is to go beyond the 25 milliseconds of the period of your oscillation so that you really break the. So it's a non-physiological manipulation. I'm not pretending this to be physiological. Yeah. No, just to be causal, because otherwise it's. You know. Say it again. Delays have, but this is not in the recurrent circuitry. Huh? This is not recurrent. This is only a top-down. So it's only how things are transmitted down. It's not in the recurrent circuitry that would change totally. Yeah. Here it's really only when people get things, but there's not much recurrent. Yes. So when we do that, then the question is, so how much of the rate effects did change when we manipulated this? So if the coherence of the two areas was an important factor in changing those firing rates because the spikes were arriving at the right time in the depolarizing period of the neuron, then you would expect that much of that modulation in rates was abolished when we did this manipulation. And instead it wasn't. So this is attention synchronous is the control case. Attention asynchronous is when we do this trick. and the non-attention condition is there. And you see that the modulation by attention that we saw was not hugely affected by the fact that we shuffled all the spikes. You can, yeah, this can be quantified. And what we could see is that, in fact, we could recover the same the original control attention response by changing now the prefrontal activation. So we keep the shuffle thing, but now we increase the activity in the prefrontal this way, just a bit. And what that does is that brings us back to where it was. So it seems like this additional oscillation, the additional rate effect due to the coherence between the two areas can be replaced by a non-coherent increase in firing rate in prefrontal. So then, yeah, one could say, well, it's an economical factor. You can do the same with the coherence. You can do the same with less activity in prefrontal. That is one. But yeah, we were hoping to get more of an effect here. That's the reality. Now, yeah, there's a problem with the result that we show that this holds for our network. But you know, showing that something doesn't happen in one network, it's not really showing much because it. So how general is this result that changing the synchrony between two areas doesn't really change too much what happens downstream? So we have we tried to get at it in two different ways. One is a more brute force approach, and the other is ongoing work with mathematical analysis. So one way would be, well, let's find other empty networks, because we're always working with the same empty network. So the way we built our empty network was to force to get this output. So now we want other empty networks that do this that get the same output out of this input, but that have totally different parameters. And instead of us looking for it manually, what we had is a computer to use an optimization method to find these responses for our network. So this is a social algorithm that runs in a super. We needed a pretty big supercomputer to run these big simulations and do all. So we need 50 networks at the same time, and each time you have to evaluate how far you are from this and update your weights and slowly you converge. And we found a number of different empty networks. There are 15 networks. And here you have the different parameters that we allow to vary, and you see that they are pretty different. So we found very different networks that could do the same thing. So this is just to show how different they were. And yet, when we tried the same trick, so now we hook that empty network, those 15 empty networks with our prefrontal network, we do again the same thing that I said. We tune the top down so that we get the right thing. And then we do the shuffling of the spikes between the two networks. And then we ask how much of a modulation is removed by that manipulation. So this is what we get. The coherence in the no attention case is here between the two areas. It's low. When we put attention, it's high. That is for all the networks. And when we remove the synchronization by shuffling the spikes, it goes down. So this is as expected. The coherence in MT also increases with attention and decreases if we remove if we put the shuffling between the two areas. And now, what about that change in firing rate? How much do we get? Well, this is the point that I showed you before, is the one that has the highest of all the 15 modulations. So the one that I showed was not a typical one, was the one that showed the highest rate modulation due to the coherence between the two areas. All the other 15 had 14 had an even lower effect of the synchronization between the two areas on the firing rates. That's still 15 networks. So another way of trying and getting at it more physically, more specifically, is to reduce this to a simpler model and try to do analysis. And what we use is a model published. Well, it's Brunel and Hansel. It's essentially similar to the Hakim and Brunel 1999. Only at its all-to-all connectivity. So it's a network that shows as you change the noise level input. So this is inhibitory neurons only, integrin fire inhibitory neurons, and they are receiving an input that has a mean and a noise term, and then the coupling between the neurons can be changed too. As you change these two parameters, you can go from the asynchronous to the synchronous case. The asynchronous is high CV, high Fanon factors. The synchronous case is strongly oscillatory. So you get this transition. And we wanted to ask, OK, so what is the rate modulation when you force these networks with a forcing stimulus at different frequencies? How much does the rate, the average rate, changes as we transition from these different regimes? So the idea behind was possibly the freeze proposal is fine in the synchronous case where you have this threshold, and when you put a driving force, you're going to get a firing rate increase there by a weak forcing, and instead it's not the case in the asynchronous case, and we wanted to make that explicit. So we are working on that, and this is ongoing work with Nicolas Brunel on this. So we have mapped, so reproduced that graph, essentially, connection strength external noise. We transition between the two regimes, and now what we do is we force this network with a sinusoidal forcing at various frequencies. Each one of these networks at these different points is forced at different frequencies, and what I'm plotting here is the mean firing rate change, not the modulation in the firing rate, but the mean firing rate change. How much does the firing rate change? And what we're finding is not what we were thinking originally, and that was that in this region we would have a strong firing rate enhancement, which would not be here. So in the asynchronous case, it can be done analytically. So Nicola has all the analytics, and it shows that the mean firing rate change in the asynchronous case is really small. It's order 2 in the forcing strength. But we cannot do it in the synchronous case. So we're doing it numerically there. And what we're finding now in this preliminary simulation, so we're exploring it further. We don't have enough thick sampling now. But what we're finding is that it seems like there is a region right at the bifurcation between the asynchronous and the synchronous regimes where this change in mean firing rate is maximal. So you see that this, in this case, for instance, if you're back here in the asynchronous case, you get this modulation of the firing rate that is maximal for a 40 hertz forcing. But when you go here, it gets like doubled. The firing rate modulation at about 50 hertz gets quite stronger. And then further down here, it gets weaker again. And you see similar things in the other regions that we have seen. So we have to explore this, but there might be a specific, so that might change our story about the full network. So there might be some regimes in which these networks might actually be very sensitive or more sensitive to a forcing at a specific frequency. And it's not in the asynchronous and maybe not in the synchronous regime. Here, synchronous is very synchronous. Say again? Yeah. Say it again? Yeah, that's what our network, big network, would say. This is consistent with it. Yeah. You would say that. In all the regimes, it's relatively weak, the modulation. If it's any stronger, it's right at the bifurcation. But neither here nor there. Essentially, not in the high CV. For the high CV case, which is this asynchronous case, there it's very small. Well, it's 15 points. It's hard to make. And
can you relate the parameters?
There are 15 parameters to fit. Well, or 14? No, not 10. 10 parameters. No, 1, 4. Yeah, 15 parameters, 15 points. Yeah. It took you know, a month to get 15, so.
Very strict criteria.
What? to find the networks. Yeah, well, it's difficult to get, you know, this situation here. That's not trivial. So the optimization has to work intensively to find these simulations. So yeah, I don't know. That would be great to be able to analyze the geometry of this, but yeah. So that's why we tried with this more mathematical. Yeah, not to say that the Pascal's idea, you know, I reinterpreted Pascal's idea in the hard sense, meaning, you know, routing of information as changes in firing rate. And Nicolas argues that he probably has something else in mind, not really, so, you know. But if his idea was really to change firing rates, I think that there's a real problem in the fact that the Fano factors and the CVs are very high, and we're not in these regimes where you do see more effect. So yeah, just to conclude then, so we have seen that the network can put together these irregular spiking statistics while there are strong oscillations driven by attention. But we see that the network oscillations and the synchronization does not really contribute strongly to the firing rate modulations in our hands. However, what we found is that this coherence measure between two areas was highly selective to the detection of a stimulus in the scene. And that is something interesting to pursue, maybe. And yeah, we emphasize that in order to evaluate functional role of oscillations, we need to take into account that things are very regular and very variable, and that might be a constraint into making those into understanding what oscillations are good for. And yeah, just to conclude, all the work here was done by Salvar Deep. He was a grad student in my lab, and he's now a postdoc with Xiaojing Wang. Xiaojing Wang also participated significantly. This story started as I was finishing my postdoc over there. David Gomez Cabrera was also in the lab, and he's now at Karolinska Institute. And then Stefan Troyer helped us in constraining this with the data and the results from MMT, and Nicola Brunelis, who's now participating in this last part of the mathematical modeling. Thank you.
Fifteen.
Well, I don't know how they managed to get 15%. In my case, oh well, here you can get whatever you want. I mean, it depends on your input. So essentially, you know, because you are in this, so the multiplicative factor comes from this power law, FI curve, right? So depending on how strong your input is, you get a higher or lower factor. So it's essentially the connectivity from your prefrontal to MT. As strong, if you make it stronger, then it's going to be. It's sensitive. Yeah, it has some in our networks. Yeah, what it can do is it can make. You know, you could become. In our networks, we wanted to keep that low too, because otherwise in the delay period we would have a very strong response when there is a bump in prefrontal. That's not something that people see. In principle, our network doesn't have a problem in producing a much stronger multiplicative factor. Yeah, the fact is that what I showed is that how a network with reasonable biophysics can show all these different effects. What I didn't show is why they are important and how these effects actually contribute. Maybe the multiplicative factor is not really what. Now there's this idea about correlations. Maybe the real point in this top-down is changing the correlations, and it doesn't really, the 15% is just a byproduct of that more essential manipulation. And that's, if that were the case, then we wouldn't care about 15%.